All right, well, we want to continue talking about the essence of biblical poetry. We've only dealt so far with this particular poem, which is not even in the Bible, but we have observed a couple of things. We've observed the nature of parallel terms. We've observed the nature of our poetic distinction of end rhyme. And we want to now begin to explore to what extent these kinds of conventional understandings, these implicit contracts about what poetry is, will serve us when we come to study biblical poetry. Now, before we do that, let me just give you a few hints on terminology. And again, I hate to do this because it's a shame that I even have to. But for some reason, if you get into reading about biblical poetry, you will discover that a number of different terms are used to describe the very same thing. And I don't know why that is. I think it's because people writing on this subject don't read other people's writings, which I don't think is the case, or they keep themselves in work by creating new terms so that it seems that they know something that no one else knows. But for some reason, there's a lot of variance in the terms that are used. And all we're talking about, I'm going to erase this second line, all we're talking about with all of these terms is this phrase and this phrase. Now, can anyone remember what Tremper Longman, what terminology he uses? Okay, well, he does use that at one point, and that is really the more standard to speak of a portion of the line. I'm going to do it this way. Actually, I'll do it the other way. I'll do line. In other words, this is a full line and portion of a line. All right? Now, the most standard terminology is to refer to the line as, let's say, if it's a two-part line, two halves, as in bicycle, to refer to that as a bicolon. All right? And then the portion of the line is referred to simply as a colon, okay, which some people want to avoid because it has other associations, and it's, you know, but it's, that's academic terminology. Bicolon for a two-part line. Some refer to, if you have a three-part line, which is possible in Hebrew, you would refer to that as a tricolon. You can even have a tetracolon, which is four-part line, but then most people would divide that into two bicola. Okay? Well, that's pretty standard terminology. Others, like Robert Loth, that we'll talk about in just a minute, refers to the line itself as a verse. Well, that makes sense. And a portion of the line as a verse member. Well, that also makes sense, although it's not real convenient to have to say verse member each time. One of my personal favorites is to refer to the portion of the line over here. Well, let me see. Should I do it that way? No, actually, some people refer to the whole line itself as a stick, S-T-I-C-H, from the Greek stichos, which means a row or a line. So this is other standard terminology that you see in some writings. And then, of course, a portion of a stick is a hemistick. Okay, so you've got hemistick. And our dear Dr. Vashels, I think, sometimes uses that term. I do too as well, stick, hemistick. Now, to confuse us further, and this is just to show you what we have to put up with, you know, in trying to learn this stuff. To confuse us further, Norman Gottwald refers to the portion of the line as a stick, okay? And the two-part line itself as a distich, which is not to be mispronounced as dipstick, okay? Stick and distich. All right, well, you begin to get the idea, and I could go on. Robert Alter refers to the line as a poetic line and to the portion of the line as a verset. I'm going to talk a little bit about Alter's work in a little while, so you'll hear me use the word verset, and I'll try to pause and say, well, what he means by that is a portion of a line, a colon. See if there are any others. Well, one of the more sensible ones is James Kugel's approach, and I'm going to talk about him in just a minute, too. He refers to the line itself as a sentence, and the two halves as simply capital A, capital B, A, B, for the two members of that sentence. Okay, so that's some terminology. I wish we didn't have to talk about it, but it's good just to write a few of those things down so that when you read something, and you will read different things in commentaries or whatever, that will refer to portions of the line with this kind of terminology. When I first started reading into this subject, I thought, man, there's a lot to learn. And then I said, no, actually, there's a lot of terms for the same stuff. Okay, so you can take some comfort in that. Well, that's terminology, but what about then the question of Old Testament poetry? We talked a little bit about what is poetry. Let's move on to point three. What is Old Testament poetry? Well, what did we see when we were looking at roses are red, violets are blue? One of the first things that came to mind was rhyme. So your point A at the bottom of that page, write in the word rhyme, question mark. Is there rhyme in biblical poetry? Well, of course, if there were, or if there is, I'm not going to prejudice you yet, the rhyme would be in the Hebrew, not in the English, you know, so it'd be a problem to spot it. And there have been valiant efforts made to demonstrate that there is rhyme, end rhyme, in Hebrew. However, these have failed. A fellow by the name of Jean Leclerc, back in 1688, provided a scholarly treatment of this particular subject. The only thing is, he worked his system out very nicely, and then others pointed out that his system would make not only biblical poetry rhyme, but virtually everything in the Bible rhyme. He just come up with a clever system to discover rhyme in most everything. So it really didn't get off the ground. There is not, in Hebrew poetry or in Old Testament poetry, end rhyme. That's one convention that we expect in some of our poetical literature, and not in all of it, of course, but in some of it we expect to find end rhyme. In the Bible, you don't really find that. Of course, not in the English and not also in the Hebrew. That does not mean, however, that the writers in the Bible were unconcerned with the sounds of words. Carol, I think, mentioned that we had alliteration here. Roses are red. Well, the Bible makes a lot of use of those kinds of sounds. So those of you who've had a little bit of Hebrew or anticipate ever taking it, I try to get one plug in for taking Hebrew, you know, every chance I get. Those of you who've had it, you can discover some wonderful beauties in biblical narrative if you're listening with your ear to what the Hebrew says. And what I'm going to do is I'm just going to read you something, a couple of lines in Hebrew, one from Isaiah 24, verse 16, so you can hear it. And then I'm going to show you how the NIV translates it, because they did a pretty good job of trying to capture some of that alliteration, some of the sounds. This is the way it sounds in Hebrew. Va'omar, razili, razili, oili, bogadim bagadu, uveged bogadim bagadu. Hey, a lot of blah, 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 you know. Yabada, dabada, dabada, you heard me say. Well, this is what it actually means. It's a rather doleful thing. The NIV translates it this way. And I said, I waste away, woe is me, traitors betray with treachery, traitors betray. Okay, you get the traitors betray with treachery, traitors betray. Get the same kind of alliteration, different consonants and so forth, but it's the same idea. Now, that's what the NIV tries to do. It tries to be alert to the rhetoric, the rhetorical force of the text, and will sometimes sacrifice lexical accuracy, you know, the exact meaning of words, in order to capture some of the force of the text and the impact that it would have had on an original hearer, in terms of emotive force. Let me give you one other example that's sort of similar. I always joked about saying similar, and there I said it on tape. Anyway, Isaiah 22:5 reads this way in Hebrew: Ki yom mehuma umevusa umevucha. And the translation is: For it is a day of tumult, trampling, turmoil. Okay, again, the translators of the NIV obviously were aware of the alliteration of the assonance in that line and tried to capture it. Now, the point is that biblical writers don't play with the sounds of words quite the way we do in Roses Are Red, Violets Are Blue, and We Want That to Rhyme with You. They don't go for end rhyme, except it does occur occasionally, but more, I think, coincidentally. But they did exploit the potential of sounds and the impact that sounds can have with treachery, traitors, betray. That's when someone has eaten your dessert. You know, woe is me, I waste away, woe is me. With traitors betray, with treachery, traitors. I'm sure it's more serious than that, actually. So rhyme is something that you shouldn't be looking for. And that's a great thing, because we're reading, most of you in this class are going to be reading the text in translation. It would be a shame, really, if the great beauty of the text were in rhyme, necessarily, wouldn't it? Now, that's not where the genius of biblical poetry lies. What about rhythm? We notice the meter of this. The roses are red, violets are blue, a certain kind of rhythm, an accentual rhythm. What about that? Do we have in, that's point B, by the way, do we have in biblical poetry, do we have a strict system of meter? Can we scan it as you scan Greek classical poetry, iambic pentameter, or whatever these different terms are that are used to describe a certain kind of rigorous meter? Well, no, we don't. Again, there have been attempts to find it. In fact, Robert Loth, who's the man who is responsible for first talking about parallelism in a book entitled Lectures on the Sacred Poetry of the Hebrews, and this is not a first edition. This is an edition from 1835, and it was already the third edition, I think. He felt that meter was the essential characteristic of all poetry. And so he assumed, well, of course, biblical poetry, because it is poetic, must have meter. The only problem is he confessed that he was unable to find it. And so if it was once there, it either had been messed up in transmission or for some reason was undetectable to us now. Maybe we hadn't just hadn't figured it out. Well, I think most people nowadays, most scholars are willing to say we shouldn't be looking for the biblical poetry to be to follow a strict meter such as we have in classical Greek poetry or in a Shakespearean sonnet, for instance. Now, the reason that's an important point to make, again, is that commentators who followed that scheme often would get a metrical pattern in their minds and then begin to change verses because the verse didn't fit the metrical pattern. And often in the critical notes at the bottom of a text, a critical Hebrew text, for instance, it will say, delete metri causa, for the cause of meter. And whenever you see that, you can delete that note and don't think about it. So we're not really looking for a strict kind of regular meter. However, there is a certain kind of living, vibrant rhythm to biblical poetry, but it's sort of a free rhythm that we have. So again, it's not as regular even as our roses are red, violets are blue example. So that's not, again, is not the essence of biblical poetry. Third possibility, also something that Robert Loth talked a lot about, and that is parallelism. Parallelism. And this has become the most influential of Robert Loth's points, the things that he talked about. He really thought meter was more important than parallelism, but in fact, parallelism has turned out in the history of the study of biblical poetry to be more important. And this is his definition of parallelism. This is what Robert Loth said about it. And remember, this is writing at a time when people were more patient. You know, they hadn't watched as many Nike ads where, you know, get the point across and let's move on to something else. So I won't even ask you to write this down. I just want you to get the point, okay? And we'll try to simplify it in just a minute. But this is what he wrote. The correspondence of one verse or line with another I call parallelism. When a proposition is delivered and a second is subjoined to it or drawn under it, equivalent or contrasted with it in sense, or similar to it in form of grammatical construction, these I call parallel lines, and the words or phrases answering one to another in the corresponding lines, parallel terms. That wasn't actually so bad after that build-up. But what he's saying is, you know, these would be roses are red, violets are blue. Those are parallel lines, or at least parallel phrases. Parallel terms, roses would be a parallel term to violets, and red would be a parallel term to blue. Okay, so when we will actually use that terminology, you know, parallel lines or phrases or cola and parallel terms. When I use the word term, I mean a one word or a word cluster in a line. Okay. Now, we notice also from his definition that he allows that there can be parallelism in sense or in grammatical construction. And so there were really two kinds of parallelism he was talking about. Semantic, that has to do with sense, and grammatical. Well, the latter, grammatical or syntactical parallelism, has been largely ignored until recently. And because of certain frustrations figuring out semantic parallelism, parallelism based on sense, people have begun to write rather complex books on syntactical parallelism. But again, that doesn't help us much, and it doesn't really help us in understanding the text a great deal until maybe that's further developed, and then through some scholarly distillation, there may be some harvest to reap from that distillation harvest. I mixed some good metaphors there. But at this point, it's not something that's going to help us in this class a great deal, those discussions. Semantic parallelism, parallelism of sense, however, there's an interesting debate going on there, and I think we can be helped with that. And I think you had something of an introduction to it in what you read in Longman's book. Well, let's dive in then to the debate over parallelism. That is point C. And as you look at that, I'm going to ask, are there questions or comments so far? You're all being just exceedingly good, not asking a lot of questions in this large class. And that's good, but I do want to give you opportunity from time to time. Yes, Sandra. Okay, poetics, the briefest definition, just a little review here. Poetics is a grammar of literature. So what a grammar tries to be, what it tries to accomplish for a language, poetics tries to accomplish for a literary type. You know, a certain kind of psalm or poetry in general. Okay? Well, let's go to the debate over parallelism. And I think I handed you out, and this is where we go to the fourth page I gave you. It's actually labeled at the top, Handout on Parallelism, Lecture Topic 2, page 1. You want to go there now. And I'm going to try one more time to see if this... I still don't think this is going to project, is it? Can't get a rise out. Oh, maybe that thing was off. Maybe that'll come on now. We'll see. If that comes up, I'll use it. If not, we'll not. So everyone gasp or something if anything ever appears. Oh, I see some lights. Yep. Oh. Well, we'll try this, our video audience. We're going to try this. And if it doesn't work, Christy, maybe you could give me the high sign if you're not able to get any of this. Because I'm going to write some things on this sheet. And I'm going to have to telephoto in and such to see if this will work. Now, Loth's three types of parallelism. If you've studied... if you had a course in biblical poetry at all, or even an introduction to the Psalms, you have probably heard of Loth's three types of parallelism, but of course you may not have. Many of you may not have had such a course or heard such words. Can you at all see this? Obviously you have it before you. You can see a kind of a white shape up here. Okay. The good news is the lights are low and you don't have to look at me under stark light there. Well, let's just take a look at it. If you can't see this, at least look down, and as I'm describing it, maybe you'll look up and see where I'm writing some things. But synonymous parallelism, what does that mean? Now, you read about that in Longman. So who can give a brief definition of what synonymous parallelism is? Yes, in the back. Okay, the repetition of the same thought in two different ways or with different words. C.S. Lewis talks about the same thing being said, simply tricked out in more finery or something. Now, let's take an example. Psalm 103, verse 9. And what I'm going to do here is I'm going to label parallel terms. Okay, so I'm going to just start at the beginning, and I'm going to begin with A, and I'll label parallel terms. So, and by the way, on your sheet where I have a hyphen between words, the reason I've done that is in Hebrew, that's one word. Not forever is one word. And does he contend is one word in Hebrew. So I'm going to call those terms. Not forever, A. Does he contend, B. And not perpetually, we'll call that A prime. Is he angry, B prime. A, B, A, B. Parallel lines. Synonymous parallelism. The first colon is parallel to the second colon. Phrase A is parallel to phrase B. Okay? Another example, and we'll just kind of let these wash over you for a while, and then when you've got the sense, we can talk about some other things about them. Another example of synonymous parallelism would be Psalm 103, verse 10. And again, let's start with Just labeling parallel terms. I'm going to omit the negative there because it is repeated. I'll go ahead and label it. By the way, you can see there's freedom in terms of this analytical process. When you're labeling parallel terms, the idea is to cause you to observe more closely. It's not that you get the whole book of Psalms labeled and then you come and show it to somebody and say, look at that, I've labeled all the parallel terms. Okay. Well, that's not the point. The point is to observe closely what is in the text, and this exercise helps you observe. So if somebody starts with A and somebody else starts with Z, it doesn't matter as long as it's causing you to observe what's there. So not according to our sins would be B. Does he deal would be C. With us would be D. And not A prime according to our iniquities, according to our sins, according to our iniquities, B prime. Does he reward, does he deal, C prime. Us. Well, that us and with us sufficiently similar to be parallel terms. Okay, A, B, C, D, A, B, C, D. Now, a little more terminology. I know you haven't had enough terminology all the way from stick to distich and so forth. I'm going to tell you some that's maybe a little bit more useful. First, I see a hand up back there. Yes. Oh, good idea. See, from my angle, is that better? Oh. No, back, okay. You need to get your prescriptions checked, you guys. Is that any better? It doesn't focus perfectly, you know, so if we're going for perfection here, it's not going to happen. From my vantage point, I can't see a thing, so I'm like the weatherman, you know, who's pointing and obviously doesn't know what he's pointing at. All right. Okay. Well, in terms of a little more terminology that I think is useful, you see I've got internal and external. Internal parallelism. If you say something is internal synonymous parallelism, that means within one bicolon, within one poetic line, there is a parallelism. As in this first example, not forever does he contend. A, B, A, B. So we have a minor pause in the middle and then a major pause at the end. Okay, see the two slashes, that's a major pause. This together is one poetic line and it is internally parallel. External parallelism would be a situation if we had a line like this, A, B, maybe a line. This one doesn't really work because this is still one poetic line even though it stretches to two lines in what I had to type. But if we had two full lines that were maybe A, B, C, A, B, C, D, E, F, and then again A, B, C, D, E, F, the second full poetic line paralleling the first, that would be called external parallelism or interlinear. There's inner linear within one line and there's interlinear between two lines. Well, I don't have an example right here. I have an example down Isaiah 1:10, down lower. Maybe let's go ahead and look at that one and you'll see what I mean by external parallelism. Let's label these terms. See where I am down here, Isaiah 1:10? Okay, hear the word, B, of the Lord, C, you rulers, D, of Sodom, E. Give ear, A prime, to the teaching, B prime, of our God, C prime, you people, D prime, of Gomorrah, E prime. Okay? See, A, B, C, D, E, that's one whole poetic line. And then again, A, B, C, D, E, a second line, so you've got external parallelism. And notice I also say it's external complete parallelism. These other two terms that I had up above. Complete means that there is a parallel for each term. Each term in the first member is paralleled by a term in the second member. Incomplete means that there is some variation. You may have ABC in the first member and then only BC in the second. An example of internal incomplete parallelism, if you go back up now to Psalm 24:1, we'll label these terms. The Lord's is, that's assumed, and it's not written in the Hebrew tongue, but it's assumed. The Lord's is the earth, B, and its fullness, C. The world, all right, what is the parallel term for world? What is that paralleling? The earth, okay, so we don't want to start with A again, but B prime, the world, and those who dwell in it. That parallels its fullness, okay, so C prime. Now, so you see that there is internal, it's all within one poetic line, but it's incomplete because there's not a parallel term for each term in the first half, A, B, C, B, C. It's fairly straightforward when you see it done that way. Now, again, this is just terminology for talking about things. You do sometimes read this in discussions of poetry in the Bible. Let's look at one more that is external complete parallelism, Psalm 69, verse 7. May they not be ashamed. That's one word in Hebrew, oddly enough. So we'll make that A. May they not be ashamed because of me, B, those who hope in me, C. O Lord God, I guess we better make those are distinct words, so whoops. D, O Lord God, E, of hosts, F. Now we come to a second line. See, that was a full poetic line. May they not be ashamed because of me, those who hope in you, O Lord God of hosts. Tell me if I'm, you know, raise your hand if I'm off the board here or some way. Okay, I think I'm all right. May they not be dishonored, okay, parallels, may they not be ashamed, so that's A prime. because of me, that's exactly the same. Those who seek you, those who hope in you, quite parallel. O God, all right, that the O is paralleled. It doesn't say, O Lord God. So maybe taking it, you know, again, you could say that's the and E. Or you could just say, well, that's E, and Lord is not mentioned again. Again, it's just to make you notice what's there. It doesn't really matter exactly what label you put down. Of Israel, okay, of hosts and of Israel are in some sense parallel. Okay, so that'd be F prime. So there you have external parallelism, interlinear, between two lines, and it's complete. A, B, C, D, E, F, A, B, C. Well, actually, ooh. If I do this D, E, you know, if I pick up the O and do it D, E, then it would be complete. Otherwise, we'd call it incomplete. But again, the idea is to make us notice, not so much exactly what we call it. All right, so that's synonymous parallelism. You see, saying the same thing twice in Lothian terms, the way he would describe it. Yes, Cedric, question. Twice in Lothian terms, the way he would describe it. Yes, Cedric, question. Okay. Yeah, the question I think is moving really in the direction of this. Is the second line significant? Does it teach us something more? Yeah, take us to a different level. Yes. See, I think that's what we're going to come to, and that's if you've read Longman carefully, you know that he talks about the old way of looking things, A does not equal B. The Robert Loth's way of looking at things, A equals B, pure and simple. And then probably the right view, A is less than B. In other words, B is greater than A. There's a kind of sharpening or intensification. But we're going to kind of build up to that in terms of first seeing what Loth describes, and then we'll describe some of the recent discussion that I think moves it along in the right direction. First, a few more definitions. Synonymous, we talked about. What is antithetic parallelism? Say what? All right, well, see, that's what it sounds like. It sounds like it's a mistaken impression or saying the opposite. But it's not, be careful, it's not really saying the opposite. What is it? Yes? Okay, it's using opposite terms, but to make the same point. It's saying the same thing using maybe a positive term and then a negative term. So I'm going to turn the sound down just slightly. It's buzzing a little bit. For instance, look at Proverbs 10:1. A wise son gladdens a father, but a foolish son grieves his mother. All right, let me label this a different way, and I'm not going to probably have time to label all of these, but a wise, that's a separate word, so I'm going to give it A, son, B, gladdens, C, a father, D. But a foolish, that's a negative term. See, that's the opposite of wise, so I'm going to make that negative A, minus A. But a foolish son, B, grieves, well, that's the opposite of gladden, so that's minus C, his mother. Okay, now they're both parents. You could say, well, they're complementary opposites or whatever. But I don't see that as being the significant point here. It's because in the first line, you've got good things, positive things, and I would be loath to make that kind of point regarding the mothers. Knowing my own and the mother of my children, I wouldn't dare. Okay, so I don't think that you would see those as opposites quite in the same way. But this is called antithetical parallelism because the same thing is being said, but the terms are inverted. At least one of the terms is a negative rather than a positive. Okay, one more example, Psalm 1:6. For the Lord knows the way of the righteous, but the way of the wicked will perish. What are the opposite terms there? Okay, righteous, the opposite of that is wicked. What else? Are there any others? Yeah. For the Lord to know something or to acknowledge or to recognize the way of someone is the opposite of that way perishing. What God does not recognize, does not acknowledge, does not care about will perish. Okay, so those also would be opposite terms. That's antithetic parallelism. What about synthetic parallelism? How do we define that, or how did Robert Loth define it? Synthetic, simply put, the second member advances in some way the thought of the first. The second member advances in some way the thought of the first. Example might be Psalm 14, 1 and 2. And here, if we began labeling terms, we'd have trouble finding parallel terms. we could struggle and eventually we'd come up with some ideas, but I'll just try it. The fool, A, has said, B, in his heart, C, there is no, that's one word in Hebrew, I guess that's D, God, E, they are corrupt. Okay, well, maybe they is fools. Surely it is, but they are corrupt is one word. I don't really see a parallel for that up there exactly. I mean, obviously we're thinking about the same kind of thing, but they are corrupt, so let's make that F. They commit vile deeds. Well, that would be maybe F prime, all of that together. You know, that they're corrupt, they commit vile deeds. There is no one who does good, or in the more literally, there is no do-gooder, no doer of good. You see, I'm running out of steam trying to figure out how to do parallel terms. It's really almost like we're just getting a description. One thing follows after the other. The fool has said in his heart, there is no good. They're corrupt. They commit vile deeds. There is no one who does good. Yahweh from heaven looks down upon the sons of men to see if there be a wise actor, one who acts wisely, one who seeks God, a seeker of God. Could almost be prose, because there's no real parallelism of terms so much. There's some things in apposition, a wise actor and a seeker of God. You could call that apposition, but you have that kind of thing in prose. So the problem with synthetic parallelism, and this leads us to some of the criticisms, and I think I'll turn our lights back up just a minute and go to some of the criticisms. What is the problem with Loth's system of three types, synonymous, antithetic, and synthetic? What did you learn from Longman's book about the problem there? The meaner term, in a sense, is garbage can parallelism. Some people have referred to this as garbage can parallelism. If you can't find a place for it, if it's not synonymous and not antithetic, then just toss it into synthetic parallelism, and you've labeled everything, and you feel good because you've labeled the text, even if you haven't learned anything from it. Okay, so that's been one of the big criticisms. Another criticism, simple criticism, is that synonymous and antithetic are about the same thing. They're both sort of repeating the same idea. One just happens to use a negative term or an opposite term or two, but they're pretty much the same thing. So that may be a distinction without a difference. So different things have prompted people to react to what became sort of standard practice of talking about three types of parallelism, and three and only three. Well, two different reactions. One has been to return to discussions of grammatical and syntactical parallelism. And again, that's not real helpful for us at this point, knowing that this tense is used in the first line and this other Hebrew tense is used in the second line, and that seems to be intentional. Well, that doesn't have a lot to do with the sense and thus the significance of the Hebrew lines or of the Old Testament poetry. Okay. So there may be some fruit to harvest from that later, but I think it's too early to tell. More importantly have been the reactions to semantic parallelisms, parallelism dealing with sense. And one reaction has been simply to multiply the number of categories. Three is not enough, synonymous, antithetic, synthetic. So there have been some who've come along and say, well, we need to come up with more kinds of parallelism, multiply the categories. What are some of the new kinds that are being talked about these days? Longman mentioned some of these. Anyone remember some of his terms? Yeah. Emblematic. Okay, what is that? Okay, as a deer pants for the water, so my heart thirsteth, longeth after thee, quoth King James. As the deer is an emblem, and the action of the deer, the thirst of the deer for water, is an emblem of my thirst for God. Okay? Emblematic parallelism. What's another? Repetitive parallelism, sometimes called climactic parallelism or climactic or stepladder parallelism, where you're kind of repeating and building. Ascribe to the Lord. How does that go? Ascribe to the Lord. I should have memorized that, shouldn't I? It's not one of our memory verses. Ascribe to the Lord the glory. Okay, ascribe to the Lord, O mighty ones, ascribe to the Lord glory and strength, ascribe to the Lord the glory due His name. Here the repetition of ascribe to the Lord, ascribe to the Lord, but there's kind of a building aspect to it. So it's sometimes called climactic or stepladder parallelism. What else? Oh, chiasm. Q chiastic parallelism from Sigma Chi. You didn't know that there was a parallelism that was named after a fraternity group. Actually, that's not the case. It was named after a Greek letter, okay, the letter chi, or chi. We sometimes pronounce it if we're fraternity guys, which I never was. But the chi, why do we use the term chi? Okay, it's a crossover parallelism, the inversion of the order of terms. If we had, instead of ABC, ABC, if we had ABC, CBA, that would be a chiastic or chiastic parallelism. The way that came about is if you had, say, a simple line, AB, and then the next line is BA, this term parallels that one, and this term parallels that one. And so the order of them, the inverse order, creates a chi or a chi. Okay, that's another kind of parallelism. So there's been this tendency to expand categories, but there's a sense that it's never quite enough. We could expand to 20, 30, 40. We could start learning these grand taxonomies and all these different names and such, but it'd be like all these terms here. We don't need that many terms. There's something else going on here. Maybe there's another way to go at it. Well, James Kugel comes along, and I've got a place for him on your outline. If you look at James Kugel's redefinition, point three under C, James Kugel, redefinition of parallelism, he redefines it as what he calls a seconding sequence. He says we cannot reduce all parallel lines to three, but rather we must look carefully at the relationship of each one. And in his view, the genius of parallelism is sharpening. Okay, A, and what's more, B. You know, kind of, it's, you know, if you're a roofer, if you've ever done roofing, you set the nail with a light tap, and then you drive it home with a harder tap. Okay, and the biblical poetry is kind of like that. It says it, and then it drives it home. It says it, A, then it drives it home, B. So there's this intensification or sharpening. He says the problem with Kugel's criticism of Loth's attempt and his description is that it tends to obscure this emphatic seconding character of the second phrase in a bicolon. Now, let me give you an example from Kugel that will show you what he's talking about. You see point B on your outline, an example, Isaiah 1:3. This is the example he gives in his book, and it's translated simply this way: an ox knows his master, and an ass its master's trough. Israel does not know. My people does not understand. I don't have the text written out for you, but if you can look this up later in your Bibles or turn to it right now. An ox knows its master, an ass its master's trough. Israel does not know. My people does not understand. Now, the normal approach to these verses prior to Kugel's discussion and some of these recent discussions has been simply to say, well, you've got in the first line, an ox knows his master, but then you don't have in the following lines, you don't have the verb knows, and so in the second line you have, and an ass its master's trough, and trough is really added for balance. It's added just as ballast, okay? Because you left out knows, you left out one word, you got to put in another word. That's been kind of the approach, and you can read that in commentaries. It's just ballasting, it's called, making it balance. Well, Kugel comments in a different fashion, and this is what he has to say. So listen carefully to what he says about it. If biblical parallelism were merely a repetition, the meaning of this verse would be, an ox knows its master and an ass its master's trough. Israel does not know. My people does not understand. In other words, it means what it says. Any reader would, of course, be aware that some sort of unflattering comparison is being made. But if, in place of mere restatement, one allows B, that is the second line, some independent existence, this series of clauses presents itself as a kind of progression. How is the first clause different from the second? The same verb, know, obey, governs both halves. The animal of the first was hardly considered the most praiseworthy of beasts. Nevertheless, ox is in several respects considered superior to its frequent pair, ass. More important, parallel to the owner of the first is master's trough in the second. The cumulative effect of these differences is the establishment of a climactic descent, okay, a downward spiral. An ox knows its owner, and even an ass, who may not be very obedient or attentive, at least knows where to stand to be fed, i.e., it knows its master's trough. But Israel does not know or obey even this much. In fact, my people don't understand at all. You see, so it's starting a downward descent, a climactic descent, whereby the ass is worse than the ox. And where does Israel come in the sequence? They don't even know who feeds them. They don't even know to stand at the trough that feeds them. Okay? So rather than just writing a line off and saying, well, the master's trough and such, that's just ballasting. I think Kugel is on to something here. And most Old Testament scholars and commentators and such are beginning to move in this direction of seeing that there's more going on in this biblical poetry than simply saying the same thing twice. It's saying it once, and then it's saying it in a more graphic or more powerful way. Now, so Kugel's thesis, in kind of summary form, is that the essence of biblical parallelism is seconding. B is subjoined, that is, it joined to A, and is hence more emphatic. B has an emphatic seconding character. And it's this, more than any aesthetic of symmetry or paralleling, which is at the heart of biblical parallelism. Now, I'm going to say this, if you didn't follow that, I'm going to say it several different ways, so just catch it one way, okay? You might think, oh, yeah, I don't know what he's talking about. Well, I think you eventually will, okay? So don't ask me to repeat it, but if at the end of all my saying it, you don't understand it, then we'll go back and work on it a little bit more. So to give you one other quote from Kugel, he says, biblical parallelism, and you might want to write this one down, you could write this one down, biblical parallelism is of one sort, A, and what's more, B, or it's of 100 sorts, but it is not 3. Okay, biblical parallelism is of one sort, A, and what's more, B, that seconding sequence, or it's of 100 sorts. We need to keep multiplying categories, emblematic, chiastic, stepladder, repetitive, whatever. You know, we're going to have to go on and on, but it's not just 3. He sees that Loth's categories have tended toward reducing the biblical text, toward reductionism. Now, how do we evaluate Kugel's theory? I would say, as I've already indicated, I think he's onto something. I think it helps us. All we need to beware of is not to become, as many good ideas and good men who've had creative minds have been followed by what are sometimes called the terrible simplifiers. People who take the basic idea and make it an absolute, and thus end up doing a disservice to the great mind that was originally behind the idea, because they push it to the extreme to where it no longer is quite true. And so if we were to say every line of biblical poetry must have this emphatic seconding character, A and what's more, B, then I think we would be going beyond what James Kugel would even want to see. But he does want us to look for that. The nature of the relationship between A and B, or the first line and second line, is complex and varied, and it is the task of the interpreter to determine in each case what the nature of the relationship is. Now, all this is doing is saying it invites us to inspect closely not only the first half of a line, but the second half. Now, you know, and that's a lesson we need to learn, because, you know, you could cut your reading time in half. Since there is parallelism in biblical poetry, just read the first half of every line and you'll be done with your assignment a lot sooner. No, I think you would miss a great deal if you took that route. So, I'm just looking at the clock and wondering if we have time to talk at all about Alter. I tell you what, let's go ahead and take another break at this point.